Hi, I'm Mark Hurst, founder of Creative Good, and I am joined once again today by Tricia Davies from The Public Good. Hi, Tricia.
Hi, Mark.
This is our second conversation talking about listening to customers, broadly defined, in the private sector and in the public sector, which is your expertise at The Public Good. And in our first conversation, we bridged those worlds a little bit, but we talked a little more about my work in the private sector with customer experience. But this time, we both thought it would be interesting to talk about your work and especially how you listen to customers / citizens, constituents in your work with the public sector. Do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate these conversations. It's fun to, explore new ideas. As I said in last time, and you have a very straightforward approach, which I think makes sense. And no matter what field you're working in, public sector, private sector, it doesn't matter. It just makes sense in so many ways. There's some areas that I want to explore with you, and I want to sort of challenge and throw back at you. How might you do this? So let me step back and give a little context. So last week when we talked about, we kind of just did a very general sort of overview of listening to your customers and why it's important. And we talked a little bit about the case study that you wrote about in the Prospect Park and sort of the importance of finding a pain point, but that it doesn't necessarily come organically, or it does come organically, but it only comes after some real legitimate listening and observing to the customers, as you call them, customers. I'm going to refer to them, because I'm working in the public sector, as my public customers. I'm going to say public customers, meaning any of us and all of us who have any opportunity to have an experience or sometimes use a product, but more often than not, it's mostly experiencing something that is offered in the public realm. So something that's not necessarily for sale, but rather something that we all sort of benefit from. So these are what I'm going to refer to as the public customers. We talked about this a little bit last week in terms of the Prospect Park experience. And then we also talked a little bit about the idea of rules, because you brought that up in your case study in terms of that rule with the dogs on the leash. I don't know if you want to give a quick, what was the importance of having a rule, and why, and how did that sort of lead to, it was the pathway to creating better experience for all the park goers, right?
Yeah. You're bringing up the Prospect Park case study I wrote about in my book, Customers Included, in which Tupper Thomas, a young park administrator in 1979 or 1980, wanted to figure out how to improve the experience for park goers, and the park was in really bad shape. Long story short, she did a bunch of interviews, and she found that there was a key unmet need that the people using the park, who were chiefly dog walkers, did not like the existing rule from the city that they had to keep their dogs on the leash. So by challenging that rule, and she was successful in getting leash laws, maybe the first leash laws in the country passed, she was able to remove a constraint that had been imposed by this city regulation. And I know you have some experience both as a consultant at the Public Good, but also in your own private life as a citizen dealing with some of the rules here in New York City that are obstacles to your own better experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the case study I wanted to mention to you, and I wrote about this in my newsletter recently, just a very high level experience, is the case of small business owners that the city wants to be able to help. So I usually start my work out when I'm working with a client or any type of client that I'm working with. We start with like, well, what is the goal that you're trying to accomplish? What's the either the why or the question or the problem or the issue, or what's the policy goal? What is the policy goal that you want to actually be able to accomplish? And for the city, having women and minority owned, and of course, there are other populations, groups, stakeholders that you could include in that. But I'm just going to say, for simplicity's sake, women and minorities, the city and government in general has an interest in creating incentives to support and grow businesses, mostly small businesses that are owned by women and minorities, because they've historically been left out of our economy and our capital markets. And so providing incentives to for women and minorities to grow and build their businesses is a good thing. And the way that the government can do this is that they can create incentives. They can say, okay, well, you know, we purchase, the city of New York purchases billions of dollars of services and goods every year. There's a huge market. And what they've been doing consistently over the past few years, because they've been modifying the rules around certification for women and minority-owned businesses, is that if you are certified as a women or minority business or some other protected class, that you will, if you bid on, a procurement to provide services, it could be, you know, park cleanup, it could be goods, products, medicines, foods, anything that the city's procuring, that if you are certified, a procurement may, say, award you a certain number, like sort of bonus points. And you'll have an advantage in being able to contract with the city. So there's this incentive that the city's created to do this and to promote it. And they're always sort of touting, and they've been very aggressive around encouraging more small businesses to start, and particularly by women and minority-owned businesses. So for myself, I'll tell you, my experience has been as a small business owner and a woman-owned business. I was originally certified probably 20 years ago. And every few years, you have to, you know, recertify, you have to fill out some paperwork, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get recertified. And my most recent experience as the business owner, the public customer, the experience of actually going through the certification process is incredibly time consuming. It's incredibly burdensome. I'll just give you some examples. I mean, for one thing, for example, is they asked me for information, which I provided them through a web page that they have. And I did that. A few weeks later, you know, they said, oh yeah, we got what we needed. You know, that's, they received everything they needed. And then a few weeks after that, they said, oh, nope, your request has been denied. You need to send a resume. And it was just one of those things that I thought, wow, it's, what year are we in now? 2023. I'm a small business owner. I've been a small business owner. I've been certified by the city for 20 years, and they want my resume. Now, I get that they want to know that I'm a real person, that I exist, but A, there's no, it doesn't, first of all, it doesn't prove that I'm a woman. Second of all, it's not the business standard. Wouldn't it be a lot easier if they just went to my LinkedIn page or my website or looked at the contracts that I've held with the city? I mean, I've held many contracts with the city. But no, in fact, they said my certification was denied because I didn't send them my resume. And there's a part of me that feels like this is absolutely ludicrous. And then there's a part of me that says, like, and I'm getting an email from a person. I think this is a real person. I don't think it was not a bot, because I tried to engage in a conversation with this person to understand, like, why are you asking for this? And then they also wanted a copy of my tax return because I need to know my revenues. Now, I get that. But again, it was one of those things where it was like, no, we just need you. You just need to email us something. And I'm like, well, I don't really like just emailing my tax returns to some random person. I mean, yeah, maybe you work for the city. I don't know. But it made me very uncomfortable because how do I know that this person isn't going to be sharing my tax return with random people? No.
Well, just even regardless of who you're sending it to, Tricia, you're making the right call. Your tax return has your date of birth and social security and other personal details. It should not go over an unencrypted connection. Doesn't matter who you're sending it to. It could be the most trustworthy person in the world. You don't send it over email. That's not the right protocol. If I remember right, you then asked the representative there in the city agency, hey, do you have a secure portal? You know, like the kind of thing that we came up with 20 years ago for uploading securely sensitive documents? And what did they say?
At that point, she said, no, because your time has expired, so you can't actually access the portal.
wait, let's just stop here for a second. You've been certified for 20 years, but we're going to deny your recertification request because you didn't send a resume, which has nothing to do with the certification process. As you say, there's nothing in the resume that proves your gender. And then they want your tax return. And then you ask for the portal and they say, you can't get on the portal. You're not certified. That's only for certified. It's like a classic catch 22. It's, as you say, it's ludicrous.
Exactly. See, I thought, I knew you would appreciate the irony of this whole story. And this isn't the first time I've had these issues. And I mean, I could just go on and on about the irony and the fact that we're talking about a city agency whose mandate is to support small businesses.
Right. And they're making life difficult for you.
Exactly. And And also just, not really engaging in best practices.
Okay. Again, just to stop here again for a moment, we're talking about you as a, as you call it, a public customer. So if, and other people may call it a constituent, again, from our first conversation, we're using the word customer here pretty broadly. But if we can accept the word customer or public customer here, you're having a customer experience with the city of New York. And you, as a customer, are intimately aware of your own experience. That's one of the ironclad laws or concepts, I guess, of customer experience work, that the customer knows their own experience a lot better than some researcher is going to be able to tell them what their experience is. So here you are, you're sharing your customer experience with me and with all of us, saying, I am a small business owner dealing with a city agency that's supposed to be making the experience better for small business owners, and yet they're actually actively making it worse. And so here we have an interesting opportunity. There is a great unmet need that you're both customer and consultant. You could help them.
Well, so here, that was the next point I wanted to ask you about, because ultimately what I really want to do is I want to make this experience better, not just for me, but for everybody, because I do truly value the policy goal that the city is trying to accomplish here. The goal being, we want to encourage more women, more small businesses to be owned and supported by women and minorities. And we want to encourage small business growth and development. I mean, I 100% agree with that. I don't want to just complain about it because, oh, poor me, like I'm having this problem. But if I'm having this problem, I'm sure there are plenty of other small businesses who are having this problem. And the issue is, where do I go? I don't even know where to go. Like, where do I begin? Like, I would literally take this on for free if the city said, you know what? You're right. We need to listen to customers so we can give these small business owners a better experience. How do we do that? So I have two questions for you, Mark. One, if the city feels like they're meeting their goals, you know, maybe they have their own goals and they're meeting it and they think they're doing a fantastic job, even though I, as a customer, feel like I'm not having a good experience, do they have an obligation to engage with the customers like myself and other small business owners? A, do they have an obligation? And B, if they do, how would you, I really truly want to know, like, what would be the best way to approach this in a way that is constructive, that sort of helps to resolve these challenges and kind of create a better experience? You are the expert on, much better expert at experience design than I am. What would you do? How would you approach this?
Well, I'm flattered that you think I'm an expert here. I was going to say you're the expert in the public sector, but I'm imagining that in the agency, there may be people who have certain goals within their own team that they perceive that they're meeting. Maybe it came down from on high that they had to add a resume requirement. So they added it and they successfully rolled it out. And they can prove that they rolled out the resume requirement because they can point to a list of people that they denied because they didn't send in a resume. And there's your name on that list. And so for them, that's a win. I'm just making this up. I'm imagining.
Because
I don't think, I mean, again, you know this better than I do, but I think people are the same in the public and the private sector. People are not actively trying to make the experience worse. They just have a narrow conception of their own goals, and they're trying to satisfy whatever the boss asks them to do. So that leads to your next question. Well, how do you break that logjam? Because presumably, if there was a better way presented to them, the people would be open, the agency would be open to actually serving small businesses better rather than harming them. But how do you present that to them in a constructive manner? I liked that word that you used, constructive. And this I can say a little bit about. I have learned over the years some do's and don'ts in contacting teams about the poor experience that they're creating. When I first started Creative Good, actually, I would post these reviews of websites, and this was very early on in the web, which means just about every website was terrible. And so I would post these reviews pointing out how terrible the website was, and then I would send it on to the contact address at the website for the team members to see it. And I thought, this is going to be a slam dunk. As soon as the team realizes that they're doing an awful job, they're going to reach out and say, first, thank you, Mark Hurst, for telling us that we're so awful. And second, can we give you a big pot of money to help us fix it? You'll never guess what happened instead, Tricia. people were not happy to find out that their work was awful, and they would not reach out. So, right. I mean, there is no silver bullet, I found. But I did write, going back to Customers Included, I did write this case study in the third section of the book, which is about the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, this question you're asking, how do you get inside an organization to convince them to change their ways? That is upstream of every other issue in experience design. It comes down to the organization. How do you persuade an organization to change? And really, an organization is made of, most are made of leaders who make the decisions and then the people who execute it. So how do you change the minds of leaders is really the question.
Mm-hmm.
I put a case study in there. It's in Science, Technology, and Society, STS studies. This is kind of a classic written by Elting Morrison back in the 1950s or 1960s. And I basically just, with credit, I rehashed Morrison's case study. And it was about the U.S. Navy. A little over 100 years ago, there was a young naval officer who I'm skipping over some of the details of the story, but essentially this young, and it's important, he was young, U.S. naval officer came across an amazing innovation that would improve the accuracy of naval ships firing on targets, which is one of their main, if you think of goals or KPIs or whatever, you know, accuracy in naval fire is one of the big ones for warships. This innovation that ended up revolutionizing years later the Navy's warfighting capabilities was simple, it was inexpensive, and it was easy to install and trivial to teach the crew how to use. All it was a little hand crank on the base of the gun. I get into the details in the case study, but just know that this innovation was not a complicated, not a huge leap of some new technology. It was very simple. And he said, my goodness, this is great. I'm going to send a letter to the admirals in Washington and let them know I have solved one of the biggest problems in the Navy. So this young naval officer sends this note to the admirals basically saying, your ships are awful, and I know how to redesign them. And the admirals said, well, what do you think they said? Oh, thank you for telling us how awful we are. They wrote him back, and well, first they didn't write him back.
Yeah.
And so he had to write him again. They ignored him. After, I don't know, 10 attempts or something, finally someone wrote back and said, dear, I forget his name, young naval officer, you claim to have found this great innovation. We have a few responses for you. Number one, your innovation doesn't work because we looked into it and it just doesn't work. And two, I don't know, they just dismissed him with four or five very condescending reasons. What it was really saying was, we're experienced older admirals who know everything. You're a young whippersnapper who knows nothing, and you are threatening our authority with this new way to manage guns.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually has a happy ending because somehow he got to President Theodore Roosevelt, who had been a Navy man earlier in his career, and Roosevelt immediately saw the value of this thing and said, we're putting it on the ships right now. And so they were able to make the change. But the point of the case study is it is often very difficult to impossible to change the minds of leaders. And you got to give it a shot sometimes. But going back to your story, how do you or we or anybody, another small business owner, get in touch with that agency and say, we have some suggestions. I don't know. It's a tall order. I don't have a great answer for you.
Yeah. First of all, I appreciate the story. I think I've learned this along my 30-odd year career in relationships is that, you know, you can be really enthusiastic about an idea and you can, maybe it is a really great idea, but there's also the sort of the politics and remembering who you are and what you're, and what the larger context and the relationships. And so, you know, and I think sometimes we forget that. And I certainly think that now in the days of, you know, with social media and everything, we've completely thrown all that out the window. Everybody feels entitled to say whatever they want to whoever they want, however they want. And sometimes it ends up in a good way and sometimes it doesn't always end up in a good way. And that's why, again, I put this out as not to say like, oh God, this agency is horrible. It's not. It's just, it's something I'm going to continue to think on because really the idea of how can we, the provider, whether it's a government agency or whether it's a consumer products company, whoever it is that's building a product that's meant to engage customers that you want to come back. You want them to be happy and delighted by your product or your experience for whatever your bottom line is, whether it's, you know, your profit or whether it's your policy goals. You want them to be happy. So I don't think there's an easy answer, but I do think that it's worth continuing to ponder and to think about, like, so what are the best ways forward, diplomatically speaking, to get your foot in the door, make your voice known, if you really want to affect some kind of change that is a systemic change for the experience of everybody, not just oneself, but really, as I'm sort of referring to the public customer, how to do that? And so I'm going to continue to ponder on that.
One thing I would add is that the public sector has an advantage over the private sector in that these use cases you're talking about are unalloyed goods. You know, serving small businesses in order to be able to operate more smoothly in New York City, that's good. You mentioned in your newsletter access to parks. Public parks should be accessible and welcoming to all citizens and visitors and friends, you know. And so if you can engage that issue and make it better, that's an unalloyed good. How about education, making it easier for parents and guardians to find the right school for their child and make that process easy and informative and welcoming? That's good. When you get into the private sector, not always, but quite often, there is a pro and a con to growing a business. You know, maybe the business doesn't have a great environmental record. And so if we increase the number of widgets sold, we're also increasing the environmental degradation elsewhere in the supply chain. Or there are probably better examples. But the nice thing about the public sector is if you can improve on the engagement that you're talking about in these contexts, it really, like you said, it really is good for everybody. But how do you, in the absence of a profit motive, how do you force that change? How do you encourage that change? I don't know. I really don't have enough experience in the public sector.
Yeah. You know, I could come up with a half a dozen more sort of examples or case studies that we could explore. And maybe, hopefully, if, you know, we have another conversation, we can, maybe I can learn from you in terms of, well, how does it work in the corporate side or the private sector? If you are a customer and you see something that's not working well, or you have an idea for how to make it better in the corporate side, you know, for a private something, a product that you've bought, and is there a way to make it better, improve the experience for yourself, maybe for others? I don't know.
It's tough on the private side because there's often corporate ownership of the assets. You know, there's IP. There's only so much you can do. I mean, the other, in my mind, the elephant in the living room here is that a lot of companies, especially tech companies now, they're simply not oriented towards building genuinely good customer experiences right now. The way to infinite riches, which all the tech companies are after these days, is often, not always, but it's often in trying to build a monopoly that squelches all competition and innovation, and it locks up users in that ecosystem so that the switching cost to leave is too high. Facebook is an excellent example of this. Mm-hmm. If you talk to people, most people will say some version of, I really don't like Facebook, but I have to be there. I really can't stand what I've read about Facebook in the news, but, you know, it's the only place I can speak to my relatives in a different country. Or there's, you know, some specific use case because, or they'll simply say, too many of my friends are there, and if they all switched to some less awful service, then I would switch in a heartbeat. But I haven't seen them switch yet. And so the switching cost is just too high. Not to dwell on Facebook, this is not all about Facebook, but Facebook is just a good example of this approach where private sector tech companies will often try to build systems that draw users in, they'll hook them and or addict them, and then they will build a wall around any kind of potential exit or switch to a better competitor. And they'll kill off all the competitors that had better ideas outside. So you have one option that ranges from mediocre to genocidally awful that really no one inside the prison can leave.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no possibility of a genuine good experience in that situation. It's just fundamentally broken from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really like talking to you, Tricia, because you're telling me examples from a different world where there are city agencies that are, at least in their mandate, are presumably trying to make things better for parents with school-age kids or elderly people who want to go to the park or, you know, small business owners who are trying to provide for their families by doing a good job in the small business. Those are all worthwhile things to work on. And there is no horrible addictive monopoly that's running the show.
Yeah. I will just say one more thing, too, is it's interesting you use the word addiction because I do look at where we are right now, our world in terms of our technology and not just the smartphone itself, but all the products within the smartphone and how it's become the new crack. It's like this is, I mean, we joke about that, right? But it's kind of scary how it does feel like in this very meta weird way that we have been sucked into this nefarious, privately owned business case that we as consumers, you think, oh, we have some choices, but do we really?
If it's all right, I want to put in a plug for my other podcast.
Yes, definitely.
Which is called Tectonic, and it's run through WFMU, which is a freeform independent radio station based in Jersey City, New Jersey. And there's more information at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. But anyway, it's a weekly show on technology, a talk show where I have guests. And 2 days ago, we're recording this on June 14th. So my June 12, 2023 show was about internet addiction. And my guest was a woman who was speaking about her experience in a 12-step program called the ITAA, Internet and Technology Addicts Anonymous. It was a really interesting story. I mean, she really shared the horrible suffering that she experienced in an addiction to screens, to online videos and video games and things like that. And we talked about that internet addiction is still, among some medical professionals, it's not recognized as a true addiction. And yet it's, from her story and other stories on the ITAA website, you can see that it's for real. It's just as addictive and just as bad as an alcohol addiction or tobacco or drugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. My comment, I forget if it was during the interview or after, my post-interview comment was, the system is working as designed. This is what the Silicon Valley engineers and designers and venture capitalists, this is what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And they've built the system that now has people having to go to 12-step programs. And it's so, this is one reason why I have been writing and trying to speak out for years now, because it's so, I don't know the right word, it's just so depressing and disappointing to me that the tech industry has, the lead industry in this country and maybe in the world in terms of its financial reach and its sheer power and influence, has decided to use that influence to build a global network of addictive products, just like you said, Tricia, on our smartphones, when they could have done almost anything else. They could have helped people immeasurably, and they chose to do really the stupidest way to move forward.
And the easiest. It's like they just took the easy way, the easiest.
Yeah.
Well, I want to suggest, I think this is, I'm definitely going to listen to your podcast, the June 12th podcast on Tectonic. But I also want to suggest, because I think the other piece of this for me is not just the addiction, but the mental health. I mean, we keep hearing about it. This whole, the addiction to, you know, everything having to do with, you know, these products and services that we don't need is just really contributing to such a huge mental health crisis. And not just the country, but I think everywhere. Suggest maybe doing some further research into that, digging into that, finding some experts who can talk about that.
And again, contrasting that with what we started with, your public sector consulting at the Public Good, I don't think you've ever, in your consulting work with city agencies, you haven't encountered problems of addiction, I mean, not coming from the agencies themselves, right? I mean, they may be bureaucratic and Byzantine in some annoying ways, but they are trying to help.
Yeah, no, I think that's you know what? Here's the thing yes. It's obviously it's not built on the profit motive. There are people who say, well, you know, we've created these industries that also kind of perpetuate themselves. For example, I worked in the city's Department of Homeless Services. I worked at several homeless nonprofit agencies back in the 90s. And the amount of money back then, we managed a budget of, I think it was like $500 million a year. It's $500 million a year to spend on homelessness. And it's just continued to grow and grow and grow. And of course, everybody keeps saying, oh, this is the solution. But I don't want to sound like a terribly cynical, but there's also this sort of bizarre incentive maybe to kind of continue to grow the industry that continues to support the programs because there's also so much money involved. I mean, it's particularly when you're talking about federal dollars. I mean, yes, they're shrinking, but there's certain things where there's the money. If the money is there, you can grow. Nobody ever starts a nonprofit with the intention of solving a problem and closing nobody ever starts a nonprofit with the intention of closing the nonprofit in a year or 2 years. Nobody says, oh, I'm going to do this so we can take care of this problem and close it. No, it's how do I create something that can continue to perpetuate? So there's definitely not the addictive quality. It's definitely not as exploitative as big tech companies, but there are some very sort of perverse things that sometimes can happen in the public sector. I like to assume that there's the best intention, that people create a program or create a service with the best intention. It doesn't maybe go the right way or doesn't succeed in solving the problems of homelessness, not because they haven't tried, maybe because there's limits to the funding, there's limits to the political willpower, there's all these other things going on.
Well, maybe that's a good tee up for our next conversation. And I want to give you some homework, Tricia, if I can be so bold. For that small business agency, can you try to find who leads it or someone who works there? Maybe you could talk to them, or maybe we could talk to them. That would be kind of interesting. Just use your example with the resume and the tax returns over plain text email to see if there's a next step.
Okay. I think that would be an interesting challenge.
Well, stay tuned, friends. Maybe we'll have an interesting follow-on conversation.
Yeah, I will work on that and we'll see what we can dig into the next time.
All right, Tricia Davies from The Public Good. Remind us your website domain again.
It is publicgoodconsulting.com.
And my name is Mark Hurst and you can find me at creativegood.com. Tricia, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Mark. Great to see you. Be well.